To parents seeking the best education for their kids, it is a whole new world out there, and it can be a confusing one. No longer is it an automatic choice to send your child to the public school in your neighborhood. Today, you have charter schools. There are online classes. And the subject of our discussion today, online K-12 charter schools. Joining us is Gary Marin. He's a professor of education at Western Michigan University. He recently co-authored a major piece along with Jessica L. Urschel for the National Education Policy Center. Its title, Understanding and Improving Full-Time Virtual Schools, a study of student characteristics, school finance, and school performance in schools operated by K-12 Inc. Gary Marin, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Well, it wasn't long ago when many of us would have had absolutely no idea what an online charter school was. And now we're seeing this concept. It's opening in Michigan. It's in other states. Can you tell us how many are actually operating in Michigan?
In Michigan, the last data that we reviewed was from 2011 and 12, and at that time there was 13 of those operating. Two were large virtual schools operated by the for-profit companies, and the other are smaller district programs. And here I'm referring to the full-time virtual schools.
So when just for parents who are still kind of wrapping their brains around this concept, so you are saying with this, we don't see classrooms, we don't see in-person teachers.
Right. And there's essentially three options. There's some families that are very familiar with the option where their child is offered to take one or more courses online through their high school or their middle school. The second option that we're starting to see are blended models, which are hybrid or blended models where students spend part of the week in a virtual environment and part of the week in a face-to-face environment. Mm-hmm. And then what our research is focused on is the fastest growing part, which is these full-time virtual schools where these schools get the full dollar for the full education.
And who are the big players? I know your study focused on the company K-12 Inc. out of Herndon, Virginia. And am I correct? They're the nation's largest virtual school provider?
They're the largest virtual school provider. In fact, they're the largest for-profit operator of public schools in the nation. They're even larger than brick-and-mortar charter school companies.
And do they have operations in Michigan?
They do. They operate one large school.
So what did you want to examine in this piece you did for the National Education Policy Center? When I see the title, Understanding and Improving Full-Time Virtual Schools, that immediately makes one conclude that there is certainly room for improvement.
Essentially, all the outcome variables, outcome indicators suggest that these schools are not performing very well. And along with some other researchers at the National Education Policy Center, some researchers from Columbia, from Arizona State University, and from the University of Colorado, and myself, we all agree that this is a pretty exciting future for education in the virtual school environment. And we're very excited about that, but we're very concerned about how this is taking shape. This opportunity space is largely being designed by these for-profit companies, and we believe that the performance could be better. But when we look at the outcome variables across the board, the results are very dismal.
Give us a sense of what you found when you looked at performance across the board. Overall, you use the term weak. How bad was it?
Well, in terms of adequate yearly progress, which is a crude measure, but it's a measure that we can use across states, it's essentially saying what percent of the virtual schools are meeting state standards. And across the nation, we found that 29% of the schools are meeting state standards. When we looked at the state ratings, we found that only about 27% had acceptable ratings in terms of their state accountability systems. When we looked at their average performance in math and reading, we found that they were between 5 and 10% behind in reading. And in math, it was rather shocking, but by high school, they fell 35 percentage point behind state averages in mathematics. And we also looked at graduation rates on time. Graduation rates are very poor there as well. I think less than a third of the students are graduating on time. When we look at attrition rates, the attrition rates are just phenomenally high. There's what we call student churn. There's a lot of student mobility in and out of these schools. In some states like Colorado, 50% of the students disappear during the year. According to K-12 itself, in its own annual report, they said two-thirds of the students disappear within 2 years. So there's very high attrition rates as well. So these are all kind of crude measures, but they are all negative. There was one very rigorous study done by Credo Research Center at Stanford University. They found the 8 virtual schools in Pennsylvania were statistically far behind brick-and-mortar charter schools, which were also behind then the district schools. So across the board, we haven't seen any promising evidence, and yet, you know, we do have hope. We think that this is a pretty exciting opportunity, an area for growth, but thus far, the results are dismal. And that's why that with this report, we really want to bring attention to the issue and caution policymakers, like, let's stop and get this right.
Before rushing into supporting this.
Before lifting the caps, before rolling this out, yeah, before rushing into it. And that's what we're doing today, largely driven by very effective lobbying by these for-profit companies.
I'm speaking with Gary Mirren, who's a professor of education at Western Michigan University and recently co-authored a major study looking at the whole idea of an online K-12 charter school. And why do you think the performance is so weak, Gary? I mean, you found these troubling performance results. Why is it?
Well, I think right now the monetary incentives are great for these for-profit companies, and the monetary incentives are based on how many students they get in the door and how many students are there on the fourth Friday headcount. So their recruiting strategies are simply to recruit anybody and everybody they can get in the door. Many of the students that they are serving today don't have the metacognitive skills that are required to succeed in this model. By that, I mean they don't self-regulate. They're not self-disciplined. Many of them don't have a structured home environment in which to work online. Many of them don't have an adult instructor because this model depends on an adult in the home who is the primary instructor, and then the teacher at the virtual school is often providing a resource and support for that parent as teacher. So they're recruiting anybody and everybody right now because that's how the funding encourages them to do so.
And teacher compensation doesn't measure up well, does it?
No, they're not paid very well, and especially now we see with K-12, the close to 10% of their students have identified disabilities or they have individualized education plans, which means they're now tapping into federal and state dollars set aside for special ed. But when we analyze their spending patterns, very little money is spent on teachers and even less is spent on special ed dollars. So we don't know where that money is going, but obviously given the outcomes, we are concerned that it's not being spent on instruction.
And Gary, could a possible explanation for this weak performance just be the fact that the curriculum is inadequate?
I mean, that's one possibility. I think some of these companies that are starting the schools, some of them are connected with textbook companies, and they do have a very strong background in terms of curriculum. Others may not. I think the primary issue about performance, however, is still that having that adult in the household. And also for these models, many of them are just not spending enough on instruction. We're seeing teacher-to-student ratios of 60 to 120 students per full-time teacher at these virtual schools, and it's just not adequate. And again, they're not spending in those areas. And given the outcomes, we would expect them to be saying, wake up. It's time to, we have to start investing more in instruction. And yet we don't see them doing that. Instead, they're spending more and more money on advertising and recruitment.
Can you give us an idea and explain to us the difference between, let's say, having my child attend one of these online charter schools and me doing the homeschooling? How would that differ and how would that be the same?
First, I want to be clear. Many of these schools, the large ones, tend to be charter schools, but now we're seeing school districts themselves operating their own full-time virtual schools.
Right.
These tend to be much smaller and also tend to focus just on the high school grades. But now the difference with the homeschooling is early on with these full-time virtual schools, many of the students that turned to these schools were the students who were being homeschooled. So for the charter schools that went into this marketplace, they were able to tap, you know, new resources because bringing these students back into the public school system meant that there would be new allocations and funding for them. So they're tapping into those students. And many of those students, I think, succeeded or performed better because they were already used to working in a self-regulated environment and a structured home environment with a parent as a primary teacher. But that shifted about 5 or 6 years ago as we saw just enormously fast growth, not only in the number of states that were permitting these full-time virtual schools, but in the actual enrollments. And when a new virtual charter or new charter school opens up, a brick-and-mortar charter school, they may start with anywhere between 100 and 250 students and grow to become maybe 250 to 400 students. With these virtual schools, they will grow. Some of them are opening with 1 to 3,000 students and growing to have more than 11,000 students at a single school.
as you studied these schools, did you look into the partnerships between education officials in states where K-12 Inc. and other companies that offer online education, and the relationship between those officials and foundations and companies who will be making money from all of this? Did you find relationships that were too cozy for your liking?
Oh, certainly. And it wasn't our analysis, but The Nation magazine has done a very in-depth analysis of that purchasing of influence by K-12, and working with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They've developed model legislation, and they have a very effective program now working from state to state to introduce new legislation that will lift caps and expand this type of schooling. And again, we're not opposed to this type of schooling. Mm-hmm. We just want to slow down, figure out how to make it work, and then roll it out.
And I do hear you say very clearly that you see exciting possibilities for students with this kind of education. So the question is now, based on what you found out and where we are right now, what should parents take away from what you have found about these online charter schools?
I think, you know, many students are turned to these schools because they see the advertisements on Nickelodeon or the various sources where they're, you know, spending a lot of money recruiting students. But for the parents, they need to wake up and look at these schools and think about the effects it may have on their students, pulling them from a brick-and-mortar school, perhaps, and then having to re-enroll them. But I think it's very critical for parents, if they're going to choose this route, that they have an adult at home who's ready to be the primary instructor. Otherwise, I'm you know, it's an area that's probably the biggest concern right now, is parents just assume that the student is going to have direct interactions with their teachers, and they're going to get all the support. And it doesn't really happen. It's mostly dependent on a student and self-guided instruction. And so the student has to be very motivated and have those kind of self-regulatory, you know, behavior that in place.
And what recommendations, Gary, would you offer for policymakers? What would you say to the folks in Lansing looking at how much of this to allow in Michigan?
I think looking at outcomes, we need to stop growing the full-time virtual schools. We need to figure out why they're not performing well. We need to look at new accountability measures for them, and we need new funding mechanisms, because I think if the funding mechanisms were changed, the incentives would change and they would change their behavior. I think the second thing that we need to keep in mind is there is very promising research on the blended and hybrid models, and there's just a wide array of new models of education that are combining virtual schools with face-to-face instruction. Those probably show the most promise, and I think should be higher on the priority of policymakers.
Gary Marin, professor of education at Western Michigan University, and he recently co-authored a major piece along with Jessica L. Urschel for the National Education Policy Center. Gary Marin, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thanks, Cynthia.